Psalm study. So we are at Psalm 102. Psalm 102. So let's start with our summary statement for this psalm. Psalm 102 cries out to Yahweh and longs for the appointed time. For the Lord to appear in His glory and rebuild Zion. So go over that one more time. Psalm 102 cries out to Yahweh and longs for the appointed time for the Lord to appear in His glory and rebuild Zion. Outlined for this psalm in two parts, verses 1 to 11, the prayer of the afflicted one. Verses 12 to 28, the time of restoration coming. We'll go over that one more time. Verses 1 to 11, the prayer of the afflicted one. Verses 12 to 28, the time of restoration coming. All right, so we'll go now to our observations of Psalm 102. Psalm 102 has no author attribution. You can see the superscription there. A prayer of the afflicted, when he is overwhelmed and poureth out his complaint before the Lord. So there, it is. It's a lengthy superscription. It's stylistic, actually, in its formation, but it doesn't name an author. Now, Psalm 101 before this is attributed to David, and Psalm 103 after this is attributed to David. And traditionally, Psalm 102 has been attributed to David as well. And I would say that David writing the psalm is possible. If David wrote the psalm, then he wrote it in purely prophetic mode. Because when you look at the content of the psalm, it's obviously a time when Jerusalem lies in ruins and devastation, and a time much of exile, much after David's time, certainly not the time of his life. So it's possible that David wrote the psalm, but it fits in with other post-exilic psalms that we have already encountered. And so I would say that the authorship is just uncertain. There's no musical direction in the heading of the psalm or in the text of the psalm. There's also no occasion that is given. The only occasion that we have is just in the superscription when the afflicted one pours out his complaint before the Lord. But the occasion of that is really not given. And like the psalm before it, it envisions a future scene. This is something that has not yet happened. Psalm 102 is categorized as a lament psalm, which is something we haven't seen in a little while as we've been in book four of the Psalms. It does have the conventions of an individual lament. So you have direct addressed prayer to God in verses 1 to 2. You have a crisis complaint in verses 3 to 11. And also you'll notice that within that crisis complaint, there is a penitential element. So verse 10 lists this crisis as being due to the indignation and wrath of God. There's not a confession of sin on the part of the psalmist, but there is a penitential confession that the afflictions that are being suffered are the result of God's indignation. You also have a statement of confidence in verses 12 to 22, which is close to a catalog of praise, where the acts and attributes psalm. But you have, again, a crisis and petition in verses 23 and 24. And then you end with confidence in verses 25 to 28. So typically a lament psalm ends with a commitment to praise. In other words, the end of the psalm is committing to praise as if the petition has already been granted. And we don't exactly get that. We get more of the prophetic ending in this psalm and confidence in the end. It does have a number of minor elements, one of those being creation. We have references to God of old laying the foundation of the earth and that sort of thing. It also has elements of kingship that we have noticed, particularly in these psalms in book number 4. So we have things like the universal and eternal reign of Yahweh being referred to, as well as his seat or throne in heaven being referred to. This is also one of the Zion Psalms. We have mention of the rebuilding, the restoration of Zion, and even Jerusalem is mentioned as well. This psalm is also what I would call prophetic predictive. It is written, in fact, verse 18 makes it clear, this is written for a future generation in this appointed time of restoration. And last of all, this psalm is a messianic psalm. Now, we generally term a psalm a messianic psalm if it has some direct prophecy pertaining to the Messiah. And in this case, the writer of Hebrews quotes verses 25 to 27 of this psalm and applies them to Jesus in Hebrews chapter number 1. So we have a direct application of this psalm to Jesus Christ by a New Testament writer. So again, that would make this a messianic psalm. Psalm 102 does have connections with the previous psalms. So far, what we've seen developing in book number 4 is a pretty tight, cohesive connections between these psalms. There's some certain themes and elements that seem to be running through all of these psalms, even though we can see some different authorship and times of their writings. So all the way from Psalm 90 to Psalm 101, and those themes would be Yahweh's universal kingship and his eternality. It comes out in this psalm. Themes like the brevity of human life that's featured in some of the previous psalms, wilderness exile, future deliverance, nations worshiping Yahweh at a future time. These are elements in Psalm 102 that can also be found in these previous psalms of Book 4. Now, another connection that Psalm 102 is going to have is going to be with other penitential psalms. And the reality is, and this is something that I guess maybe was somewhat surprising to me when I set out on this study, is that penitential elements in psalms is actually kind of rare. It just doesn't happen all that often. There are 7 psalms that are identified as lament psalms that are penitential laments. So when I say penitential, I'm saying there's some sort of confession, either a confession of sin on the part of the psalmist or a confession that the afflictions being suffered are due to some sort of chastening of the Lord. And that's what I mean by penitential. So you can identify 7 different psalms that are laments that have this penitential element. And this would actually be the 5th one. So Psalms 6, 32, 38, and 51 before this are penitential laments. And there are also some psalms that are not lament psalms, but have some penitential elements. But there's not that many of them. Psalm 31, Psalm 40, Psalm 41, Psalm 69, and Psalm 73. So out of 150 psalms, you're only talking 7 penitential lament psalms and another, what would that be, another 5 psalms that have some minor penitential elements in them out of 150. So it is something that's somewhat rare. And at the outset of this study, I didn't realize that. And I wouldn't, if you'd asked me at that time, I wouldn't have thought that to be the case. I'd have thought all the Psalms are just full of confessions and all of these kind of things, and then they really are not. So when we do see them, we also see other things around them that share connection in these Psalms. So Psalm 102 is going to share connections with these other penitential elements in these other Psalms because of that. So the poetic features of Psalm 102, one of those is going to be pretty extensive use of imagery, in this case, the simile. And you can notice this if you go through the psalm and you take note of the use of the word like and the word as. And you see this in verses 3, 4, 6, 7, 9, 11, and 26. If you just pay attention to the use of like and as, and you will see this coming out. For instance, just one example, verse 3. For my days are consumed like smoke, and my bones are burned as an hearth. So this is imagery, poetic imagery that is being used. And so it is quite, I forget the word I'm trying to think of, but it's in there a lot. Also, the psalm makes use of what I would call a contrast motif. Because it relies on contrasts, and these contrasts form these motifs in this psalm. So the three main ones, one would be the eternality of God that is contrasted with the brevity of human life. The second would be the present crisis and the present crisis of the psalmist that's contrasted with the future restoration. And the third would be the present generation, which the present generation is obviously an exile generation, and the future generation that's going to be a restoration generation. All right, so we'll work our way through this psalm, 28 verses, so it's on the longish side of Psalms, but go ahead and read through this. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come unto thee. Hide not thy face from me in the day when I am in trouble. Incline thine ear unto me in the day when I call. Answer me speedily. For my days are consumed like smoke, and my bones are burned as an hearth. My heart is smitten and withered like grass, so that I forget to eat my bread. By reason of the voice of my groaning, my bones cleave to my skin. I'm like a pelican of the wilderness. I'm like an owl of the desert. I watch and am as a sparrow alone upon the housetop. Mine enemies reproach me all the day, and they that are mad against me are sworn against me. For I have eaten ashes like bread and mingled my drink with weeping. Because of thine indignation and thy wrath, for thou hast lifted me up and cast me down. My days are like a shadow that declineth, and I am withered like grass. But thou, O Lord, shalt endure forever, and thy remembrance unto all generations. Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her, yea, the set time is come. For thy servants take pleasure in her stones and favor the dust thereof. So the heathen shall fear the name of the Lord, and all the kings of the earth thy glory. When the Lord shall build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory. He will regard the prayer of the destitute and not despise their prayer. This shall be written for the generation to come, and the people which shall be created shall praise the Lord. For he hath looked down from the height of his sanctuary, from heaven did the Lord behold the earth, to hear the groaning of the prisoner, to loose those that are appointed to death, to declare the name of the Lord in Zion, and his praise in Jerusalem. When the people are gathered together in the kingdoms to serve the Lord, he weakened my strength in the way, he shortened my days. I said, O my God, take me not away in the midst of my days. Thy years are throughout all generations. Of old hast thou laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. They shall perish, but thou shalt endure. Yea, all of them shall wax old like a garment, and as a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. But thou art the same, and thy years shall have no end. The children of thy servants shall continue, and their seed shall be established before thee. Verses 1 and 2 give us the opening direct address prayer. This is a petition that asks to be heard and to be answered speedily or quickly. And it's very similar to what we see in Psalm 69 and verse number 17, which is another one of those psalms with penitential elements that I've talked about previously. And this sort of prayer, we've seen this numerous times now in the Psalms, particularly in the Lament Psalms. And we've seen this enough that we should recognize that this indicates that this is a covenantal prayer. There is some foundation for expectation or hope to be heard and be answered. There's an expectation that this petition is going to be granted, that something is going to come to pass because of God's covenant and His faithfulness to His covenant. So there's a request here that God not hide His face. Obviously, these are prayers in distress where help has not come and blessing seems to be withheld. And we might see a subtle allusion to some of the prayers of how long that we've seen in a few of the Psalms in book number 4, but more common in the earlier Psalms. But there are a number of Psalms that give this request, Psalm 13 and verse 1, Psalm 27 and verse 9, Psalm 30 and verse 7, Psalm 44 and verse 24, Psalm 69 and verse 17, Psalm 69 again, Psalm 88 and verse 14, Psalm 89 and verse 46. And I didn't really mention the connections with Psalm 89, but actually those are numerous as well, as so far all of the Psalms of book number 4 have had connections with Psalm 89 at the end of book number 3. So this one is no exception. Verses 3 to 7 then paint the picture of suffering's effects on the afflicted one who is praying in this psalm. So we get this smoke and burning imagery. In other words, nothing is accomplished or nothing lasts. It's just turned to smoke and to scorch marks like on a hearth. We have reference to heart pain and dryness inside that is like grass that is withering up. And of course, you know, we've been looking at the grass and already beginning to cut the grass. And it's very, very green and very lush looking. And we've had quite a bit of rain and quite a bit of water. Come about August and we go for weeks, and we don't have water and it's hot and it's dry and the sun's scorching things and it starts to wither, starts to turn brown. That's the imagery that's being relied upon. We have reference here to being emaciated, being bones cleaving to skin. In other words, that's sort of like, the phrase that we would say about someone, he's nothing but skin and bones. He's wasting away and losing weight and all that sort of thing. We have these reference to these birds, pelican and an owl, in verse number 6. These are large, unclean birds that are referred to, but we don't know exactly what birds these are. And there's reasons, I think, why they chose pelican here and owl. But we don't know exactly if this is what we think of as a pelican or what type of owl that might be referred to. But nevertheless, the point is, these are birds that inhabit ruins and desolate places. So in other words, the presence or prevalence of these birds is an indication of the absence of people, the absence of normal life and things going on. We also have reference to being like a sparrow on the rooftop. And so essentially he's saying that he watches like a sparrow on the rooftop. In other words, just simply observing this scene of devastation. And he's powerless to do anything about it. And he's insignificant, like a little sparrow sitting on top of the rooftop. And all these things are just happening. Verses 8 to 11 then now give us the cause of this crisis. So we move from the effects, what this has done to him. We move now to the cause of this crisis. So now we get mentioned in verse 8 of enemies, and enemies have not been mentioned a whole lot in book number 4. Some of the earlier Psalms, we saw enemies often being referred to as the source of affliction, but in book number 4, we just haven't seen enemies a whole lot. that they have sworn against him, they've covenanted against him, we might even say conspired against him, they've joined together against him, they've reproached him, they've mocked him, they've taunted him, they have sort of, you know, made him into a byword, a laughing stock, that sort of thing. The eating of ashes that he refers to, well, ashes of themselves, imagery wise, speak of mourning. And they also speak of desolation. So you could think of maybe a fire that's destroyed a town or something, and all the ashes that would be left, all the desolation, people vacated. So there's mourning and desolation that is referred to. And eating ashes like bread is given us, again, it's a simile. He's given us this imagery that rather than his daily bread, which is, you know, in other words, daily bread would just be, that's your regular experience. That's just your regular fare. You know, it's nothing special. It's nothing out of the ordinary. You just have your daily bread. Well, for that, he's had ashes. So in other words, that's been his normal. His normal has been the ashes of devastation and of mourning. Just as tears have been regularly mixed in his drink, daily as well. Now, the crisis of suffering affliction, as we look at verse number 10, is that he is suffering through God's indignation and wrath. And he says particularly that God has lifted him up and cast him down. And, of course, this would, again, echo what we read in Psalm 89 of the house of David and how that it had been brought to ruins, the crown and the throne in the dust. And then we get another reference to the brevity of life here in verse 11. Like a passing shadow, the shadow that goes down, it lasts for a short time. The withering of the grass, which is also something that is short-lived. Verses 12 to 17, then, do make a turn in this psalm. And we start getting this contrast come out now because we have the eternality of God being referred to. When you think about the eternality of God, one of the primary implications of that is simply that God's unchanged. He's unchanging, unchangeable, and unchanged. He is eternally God. And so that comes out in this psalm. So the eternality of Yahweh, he endures beyond all successive generations. In other words, people come and go and have been coming and going for thousands of years. They live a little while on the earth and then they're gone. In other words, human life is very, very short, and God is eternal. And so he outlasts all generations of men. And he's unaffected. God being unchanged and unchanging and unchangeable also means that he's unaffected by enemies. He doesn't respond. In other words, maybe think of it this way. We've all probably had the experience where someone has ruined our day. You know, we started out having a pretty good day, and, you know, we're optimistic about it. And someone has, for whatever nefarious purpose that they had, has ruined our day, you know. Well, God's not affected like that. God's mood, so to speak, is not altered by someone's arrogance or their maliciousness or their raging against him or whatever that the case may be. He's unaffected. He is ever the same. So their raging against him is ineffective. And the word for endure that is used here actually is a word that means to sit or to abide. And so it speaks of his seat of rule. And later we will get reference to him sitting in the heavens. But the Lord will arise, it says in verse number 13. And the rising of the Lord, well, that's an image of the Lord standing up. He's been seated forever, and he stands up. And when he stands up, he will visit the earth. And the result is that he will have mercy on Zion. So in the Psalms, when we see references to the Lord rising up, It has been to one of two ends. One is judgment on the wicked, and it means destruction for the wicked when the Lord rises up. And when the Lord arises, it also means blessing and deliverance for the righteous, for the faithful. And so the result will be him visiting the earth, and it will be blessing for the faithful, and it will be blessing, for he will have mercy on Zion. We see a similar reference in Psalm 82 in verse number 8 to the Lord arising. Now, the word for mercy that's used here, it's not chesed, as we oftentimes see and is oftentimes translated mercy. This is another word for mercy. So this word doesn't have the same sort of covenantal associations that we associate with chesed. This is a word that more just means love and compassion. God's going to be gracious, and that's a word that gets used as well when it says that he's going to show favor to her, favor to Zion. And the word for favor includes the idea of stooping down to show kindness. So when the Lord arises, he will show compassion and be gracious toward Zion. And this will happen, it says, when the set time is come, the appointed time, the time to favor her is come. So this will be some appointed time in the future. Now we get this reference to the servants, them taking pleasure in the stones of Zion and the dust of Zion. This is an expression of the remnant and their love for Zion and their hope for Zion in the future. The reference to heathen that we get here, it is the plural term goyim, which is nations. The nations, so when he arises, he will show mercy to Zion, and the nations will fear his name, and the kings of the earth, in other words, the kings of the nations of the earth, will see his glory. And that is the term kavod, and we'll look at that here in just a minute. So when will this happen? Well, it says in verse 16, when the Lord shall build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory. So when Yahweh appears in Zion to rebuild and to restore, which is what the word indicates, he will appear in his glory. And kavod is used here again. And kavod, as we have talked about, is that word that is oftentimes associated with kingship, with authority, with power, with rule. So when it's referring here to the appearing of Yahweh in power, in glory, so he will come in power and authority to reign as king. He will come to Zion for that purpose. And when this happens, the nations will fear his name and the nations will see his glory. And then verse 17 there at the end goes on of what will happen when he arises, when he appears in Zion in glory. He's going to rebuild Zion. The nations will fear his name and they're going to see his glory. And also the prayer of the destitute will be heard and will not be despised. In other words, the prayers of the afflicted will be answered. They will be answered. The prayers that have been prayed for generations with hope for the rebuilding and the restoration of Zion and the appearance of the king in glory, they will be answered and they will be delivered from their enemies. Verses 18 to 22 then look to this future fulfillment, and we get this indicated right away. This shall be written for the generation to come. In other words, the content of this psalm, the events of this psalm that this psalm looks to, they will be fulfilled in the time of a generation to come. Not in the generation at the time that he's writing, but in some future generation is when these will be fulfilled. Now, the word for people that is used here, it is the plural amim. Amim is the most common word that is used of Israel to refer to them as a nation. And the word, it indicates a large family group or tribe. So here it would be referring to the assembling of the tribes of Israel. Think of the promise we recently looked at that was given to Jacob in Genesis, that there would be an assembling of the tribes. And so this generation to come, these peoples which shall be created. So these tribes of Israel of this future generation, this generation that is at the time of this restoration, they will praise the Lord. They will see this. They will see the rebuilding of Zion. They will see the coming of the Lord, the appearance of the Lord in glory. We're told that God has looked down from the height of His sanctuary in heaven. In other words, He sits in the heavens and He's looked down and He's beheld the things on the earth, much like what we read about in Psalm 2. And He's going to act, and He acts to free the prisoners and deliver the sons of death. And that appointed to death is actually the benim there. So it is sons, the sons of death. And this is, I believe, a resurrection imagery that is alluded to. And then the name of the Lord will be declared or inscribed in Zion. In other words, He's going to visibly set His name in this city that is His. And His praise then will be in Jerusalem, or it will inhabit Jerusalem. In other words, it's an image of just an unceasing praise. Praise of Yahweh is going to live in Jerusalem just like people might live in a city or in a house. And then we get the gathering of the tribes in verse 22, the gathering of the tribes, and again, that's the plural, the people Amim, that are gathered together, and the kingdoms, and that word for kingdoms, which refers to realms, which has more of an idea of the, you know, geopolitical boundaries of nations. So it is another reference to nations, but it would include sort of their governance, so to speak. So it's another reference, like what we saw earlier, to kings, which is referring to the kings of the nations. So the tribes will be gathered, and the nations and the kings of the nations will be gathered to Jerusalem. They will stream to Jerusalem to serve the Lord. And in verses 23 and 24, return to this present crisis. And this is the crisis of the afflicted one. And the crisis is that the Lord has weakened and shortened His days. In other words, what's being described here is that He's being cut off early. He's not living long life here, but He's being cut off in the midst of His days, as it were. And in verses 25 to 27, give us this closing confidence. In other words, when we start this psalm in the beginning, this prayer to be heard and to be answered and all of that, we know that it has foundation. And so now we're seeing some of that confidence. What is that? Now, well, that's because Yahweh is the Creator. He is before His creation. He of old laid the foundations of the earth. And that's very similar to in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In other words, God was, and God is, and God always has been, and God always will be. So this eternality of God as Creator, He is before His creation. The creation that He made, we also get this imagery, this clothing imagery that's used in two different ways. One way that it is used is like a coat that wears out and gets threadbare. And He says this creation that God has made, it wears out. And you know, boy, do we know that. I mean, it wears out, and we have to do away with it, and we have to replace things. And not only that, He refers to clothing that has to be changed. And it could have to be changed for any number of reasons. It doesn't really give a reason why it has to be changed, but clothing that has to be changed. And the contrast is that God doesn't wear out. God never needs to be changed. He is eternal. He's unchanging. He's unchangeable. And so He is always God, and He doesn't need to be changed. He is before His creation, and by Him all these things exist. And in verse 28 closes this out really with a prophetic statement. The children, and that's the benim again, the sons of your servants will continue. The sons of your servants. This is a reference again to that remnant. That remnant will continue. In other words, the promise of a remnant in Israel, when you track that through the Old Testament and even into the New, like Paul in Romans chapters 9 to 11, the promise of a remnant means that Israel will never cease to exist as a people. Oh, yes, they didn't exist as a nation with a land. There was no Israeli state for a very long time, but they still yet did not cease to exist as a people. And there is an Israeli state today. Why? Because Israel has never ceased to exist. They will continue. They will be perpetuated. And not only that, their seed, which that means there's a future generation of the remnant of Israel that's going to be established. In other words, this is similar to promises that we've seen. They will be planted in their lands. To be established has the idea of being fixed, of being set into place and fixed upright, and so being unshakable and immovable. And they will be obviously speaking of their that generation that will be restored to the everlasting kingdom. All right, so let's move on to interpretation. Psalm 102 teaches, obviously, the eternality and the sovereignty of God. And the psalmist contrasts this with the brevity and the frailty of human life. And he shows how ineffective that humans are at thwarting God's purpose. In other words, God is before it. God is after it. He sits above it and observes it. And when he arises, he will set these things to right. So the fact that God is eternal and unchanging means that he will fulfill his word that he has promised. So when we see a psalm like this, it's not that the psalmist is just getting caught up in some sort of puritanical type of reverie, thinking about the eternality of God. What the psalmist is telling us here is that his hopes are founded because of the eternality of God, because God is unchanging. That means God's going to keep his word. God is going to do what he has promised to do, which includes the restoration of Israel, the establishing of that seed of the remnant, as well as the gathering of the nations to acknowledge and worship him and see his glory and his kingdom. So another aspect of this is that it shows us just how small that our perspective is. It's very small. It's very limited. We don't comprehend even hardly the least degree of God's eternality, of his plan and purpose, and of the flow of all history, for that matter. The messianic hope of this psalm is clearly seen through the use of this psalm to speak of Christ. So in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 to 12, the writer of Hebrews quotes verses 25 to 27 of this psalm. In the context, when he quotes these verses from this psalm, the writer of Hebrews is talking about the superiority of the Son of God, Jesus Christ, to the angels, to those created spirit beings. Because the Son alone is exalted to reign as king over the earth in the future kingdom. And the writer of Hebrews pairs Psalm 102 with Psalm 45 in speaking of this superiority of Christ over the angels. Jesus is greater than the angels because he is the creator of all, and he is eternal as opposed to the temporary creation. So we read this psalm messianically then. I'm not sure messianically is a word, a proper word, or if I just made that up. I don't know. But I know that it gave my spell check all sorts of trouble. Messianically, that's the way that we're going to read this psalm, because that's the way the New Testament uses this psalm. So then, we go back and we reread through this psalm, and we realize that Jesus Christ is the afflicted one. He is the one praying this psalm. He suffered desolation and death under the indignation and wrath of God in the midst of his enemies. But he is also the King of glory, who will appear in Zion to rebuild and restore it, to gather all the tribes of Israel together, to restore them. And in that time, all the nations of the earth will stream to Jerusalem to praise and serve him. Now that means that this psalm is a masterpiece of messianic prophecy, because it holds together these two mysterious threads of prophecy pertaining to the Messiah in the Old Testament. And that is his suffering on the one hand and his glory on the other. Something that even the prophets themselves wrestled with. This is what Peter wrote, 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 10 to 12. Of which salvation the prophets have inquired and searched diligently, who prophesied of the grace that should come unto you, searching what or what manner of time the Spirit of Christ which was in them did signify, when it testified beforehand the sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow, unto whom it was revealed that not unto themselves, but unto us they did minister the things which are now reported unto you by them that have preached the gospel unto you with the Holy Ghost sent down from heaven, which things the angels desire to look into. How could the Messiah suffer and yet be exalted as king in Zion? How can those two things be? And those prophets that wrote about these things were inquiring, it says, of the time. When will this be, and how can this be? So this psalm holds together a very difficult contrast to the suffering of the Messiah as well as his glory. Well, the prophets wrote of his suffering, they wrote of his glory, but they didn't know of the time of them, and they didn't understand, it seems, the separation of them. In other words, we today refer to the second coming of Christ. The Old Testament prophets didn't know of a second coming of Christ. They wrote of the coming of the Messiah. And so, just like in this psalm, we get a mix. But if you pay close attention, and again, you read this psalm messianically, you realize that it talks about this affliction and this glory later is a future time. It is a distinct time from this time of suffering and affliction. So again, it's just a masterpiece of messianic prophecy. Jesus also refers to this. So here's an example. This is Jesus, Matthew chapter 16, verses 21 to 27. This is during his Galilean ministry. This is when he begins to speak to his disciples about his suffering. And this is what he said. From that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him, saying, Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. But he turned and said unto Peter, Get thee behind me, Satan, thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men. Then said Jesus unto his disciples, If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? And notice this now. For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works. That's exactly what this psalm is prophesying about. All right, let's move on to applications. Just making one primary application. Some of these can have a number of applications, but just trying to focus again on sort of the unique contribution. So understanding Psalm 102 helps us again understand that God is overall and that God is in control. Our little portion of life is like nothing in terms of eternity. And our little portion of life may seem to be nothing but affliction, nothing but hardship, nothing but difficulty, nothing but devastation, nothing but ruin. Think about how many generations of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that have endured on this earth, scattered among all the nations of the earth, and not even having a modern Israeli state. How many generation after generation after generation? 1,800 years, basically. They go on. 1,900 years, they go on. Generation after generation, not even having a state in Israel. And of course, now they do. Our little slice of life is so small, and it may seem to be filled with bitterness and disappointment and distress, but our perspective is very small, and eternity really is infinitely longer than what our short time of this mortal life experience is. And we are assured in a psalm like this, the Lord will come. He will come. I mean, we've already seen the suffering part of this psalm has been fulfilled. We've already seen that. The Lord will come, and the glory of His kingdom will endure forever in the restored creation with glorified saints. All right, any questions on Psalm 102? You know, it's interesting when you read it. So in its original setting, the psalm is written as an individual lament, but it really is more of a national lament. So it's almost like a psalm writer is writing of his own experience in place of or in representation of the whole nation of Israel. And then, you know, you understand the psalm as messianic prophecy. So then you go back and you see that this is as Jesus, as the psalmist. But Jesus is also that representative of Israel. And so, yes, I think it's actually multi-layered that way.